So, as a little bit of a recap, just like in the Gospels, Jesus has a series of trials or hearings. The Apostle Paul has had a series of trials or hearings. And they're even more parallel than that. In the case of Jesus, he has trials before the Jewish council, the Jewish rulers, and then he has a trial before a Roman governor, Pilate, and then a Herod Antipas, and then back to a Roman governor, Pilate again. In the case of Paul, not only has he had trials before the Jewish rulers and the Sanhedrin council, but he's gone before a Roman governor, whose name was Festus, and then before Herod Agrippa II, and then before another governor whose name is Felix. I'm sorry, I switched those. Felix and then Festus. So a lot of parallels. And that's one of the things we've been talking about as Luke writes Luke and Acts. He's showing us that a disciple is like his master, right? So just what Jesus experienced, Peter and Paul experienced. But of course, in the big scheme of things, really, from Acts chapter 19, we have known that Paul's ultimate intent is to go where? He wants to go to the city of Rome. Well, now we're going to read the account in chapter 27 that gets us from where he was on trial in Caesarea, part of the way, at least today, to the city of Rome itself. So let's look now here in Acts chapter 27. There are just some basic things that once you know them about what ancient travel at sea was like will help you to understand what is going to make this this trip so very dangerous and why it ends up in almost near disaster like it does. Here's again, I guess I got to show you this, right? We've been looking at it every class. So this kind of shows you these summary statements we've been looking at as we've made our way through the book, as we now make our journey to Rome itself. So here's a couple of things that you need to know. In the ancient world, travel by sea could really only happen at certain times of the year because of the weather and because of the climate. So what we know from ancient history is that essentially from early November to early March, they shut down sea travel altogether. That's why it takes so long, in part, to get from one place to another. Not only are you traveling by a relatively slow means of travel, by a ship, but you can only sail certain times of the year. So we know that they didn't sail at all from early November on our calendar to early March. Not only that, we also know that they would substantially cut down on sea travel from the time of mid-September. It could get very dangerous by mid-September. Now, that's very relevant here for this account for this reason. Look in chapter 27 and verse 9, and we learn the time of the year this travel is taking place. According to 27:9, what is the time of the year? After the fast. And do you know what does the fast, what was the one Jewish holy day in which they were required to fast? The Day of Atonement. And on our calendar, the Day of Atonement basically falls in late September, early October. So remember I told you, they don't travel at all early November. They start to seriously curtail sea travel by mid-September. Well, what we've just been told is it is late September / early October when this trip is going to take place. So the point is, when this trip is taking place, we have already entered a pretty dangerous time at which to travel. So that's one thing to understand about this. The other thing to understand is, in general, they're going to be sailing that away. They're trying to get to Rome. So they're going west. In this part of the world, the prevailing winds come from the west. So they are literally sailing into the wind. So that also makes it a more complicated. Some of you who've traveled by plane overseas, you know that the jet stream makes a difference depending on whether you're going east or west. It can really make your trip slower or faster. Same kind of thing, only more so in the case of what's going to go on here. All right, so with that in mind, let's just get started. Incidentally, Years ago, there was this video made called the, I forget now exactly, the Visualized Book of Acts, I think. It's about 2.5 hours, and it's all been uploaded, I'm sure illegally, on YouTube. But it literally, the only words spoken are the words from the biblical text. But it's just kind of acted out. And I actually went back and watched last night the Acts 27 chapter because it just kind of helps you get a feel for how all of these details go. I actually thought about playing it up here, but I knew y'all just fall asleep once I started this video. So we'll just keep it going this way here. So verse 1, when it was decided that we should set sail for Italy, they delivered Paul and some other prisoners to a centurion of the Augustan cohort named Julius. Let me ask you this question. Generally speaking, have Roman soldiers been good for Paul or bad for Paul? They've been good. Yeah, that's exactly right. So we're kind of led to think, hey, maybe this will be another one of these guys as well. Yeah. That's exactly right. They're still in Caesarea Maritima. So it might be hard on this map to see, I realize, but a lot of you have Bibles that have maps in the back that maybe even have the trip to Rome, or maybe it just has a map of the missionary journeys that might be easier to read. But yes, they are in Caesarea Maritima. Yeah. Cornelius? Oh, now, I can't prove he wasn't, Brad. So if you want to theorize, Cornelius has talked to this guy and said, hey, you be nice to Paul. I cannot dispute you for sure. So if you want to go with that one, we'll just go with that one here. Yeah, I hadn't thought about that before, but sure, that's interesting. Yeah. All right, so verse 2 says, and embarking in a ship of Adramidium, which is up on the coast of what we would call Turkey or what they would call Asia, which was about to sail to the ports along the coast of Asia, we put out to sea accompanied by Aristarchus, a Macedonian from Thessalonica. When, you know, periodically we've seen these people that Paul has taught the gospel who travel with him. Verse 3 says, the next day we put in at Sidon. You can see right now they've just started the trip, kind of hugging the coast as they make their way up the land of Palestine. And you know, I always talk to y'all about being a good guesser, which is if you think about what's just happened, see if you can guess and see what will happen. And you may be right or you may not be right. But if you were guessing, hey, these Roman soldiers have been pretty nice to Paul, all things considered. Well, look at what verse 3 says. Julius treated Paul kindly and gave him leave to go to his friends and be cared for. Verse 4, and putting out to sea from there, we sailed under, now my Bible says, under the lee of Cyprus. Is that what your Bible says? Shelter. And that's what it means. It's just lee here is using more of like terms you would use for a trip by by boat. But yeah, that's exactly right. So do you see where the island of Cyprus is? So think about it. If the prevailing winds are coming from the west, so from this way, then they're trying to use land to basically shield them from the prevailing winds, okay? To try to be able to sort of make their way even past the winds. All right, and it says at the end of verse 4, because the winds were against us. Verse 5, when we had sailed across the open sea along the coast of Cilicia and Pamphylia, we came to Myra in Lycia. And you can see, if you're close enough, where Myra is. And again, hopefully you've got a map you can follow along as well. Now here, what's going to happen is, remember, this ship is eventually heading north up the coast of Asia. They're trying to get to Rome, so they're going to have to transfer ships at some point, right? So that's what happens here. Verse 6 says, there the centurion found a ship of Alexandria. So Alexandria is in Egypt, North Africa, in other words. That was sort of the breadbasket of the Roman Empire. A lot of the grain came from Egypt, and so it would be like a big cargo ship with grain, basically. All right? It would be taking grain to Rome. So he says in verse 6, the centurion found the ship of Alexandria sailing for Italy and put us on board. We sailed slowly for a number of days and arrived with difficulty off Cnidus. That's an odd-sounding name for us, right? I have no idea how they would pronounce it. But you can see here, again, they're kind of hugging the coastline here. And I know we've got some experienced sailors here. Brother Toomer over here, you're a big shrimp. You were old-time shrimp boater, right? And I know Paul has a boat, and I'm trying to think who else. I know, John, you have a boat you terrify or used to kids with at camp. So some of y'all can really identify with this. So it says in verse 7, we sailed slowly for a number of days and arrived with difficulty off Cnidus. And as the wind did not allow us to go farther, we sailed under the lee of Crete. So you can see where the island of Crete is. So I came up with a song. Under the lee, it will be better if we don't get wetter down in the sea. So that was my big song I came up with here. Don't you think? Now, Mickey, let's put that one in the VBS rotation, all right, on the singing night, Sunday night. All right. I'm sorry your preacher's an idiot, but, you know, it's what we got to work with around here. So verse 8 says, coasting along it with difficulty, we came to a place called Fair Havens, which was near the city of Lycia. Now, all of these details are suggesting to us just how difficult this trip is turning out to be. And I don't know if any of y'all have ever been up on a plane where it got so rocky and so stormy, they basically had to say, we're just going to go back. We got to turn back, or we're just going to have to land somewhere here. And I know we've got some old private pilots around here. Maybe you've experienced that. Maybe some of you have landed involuntarily. I don't know. But so you can understand here how it's starting to get very dangerous. So it says this in verse 9. Since much time had passed, so they already started when it was starting to get dangerous. Now it's really starting to get to the dangerous season. And the voyage was now dangerous even because the fast was already over. So we're past mid-October, roughly. You know, depending on when it fell, when the Day of Atonement happened to fall this particular year, we could be past mid-October. And remember, early November is when they stop altogether. Paul advised them, saying, sirs, I perceive that the voyage will be with injury and much loss, not only of the cargo and the ship, but also of our lives. Now, it is interesting that he does not say, and Luke doesn't say, in the spirit, which is typically our cue that, like, God is revealing this. And the fact that Paul says he perceives this sort of sounds like this isn't so much Paul speaking by divine inspiration as much as it is common sense, right? Hey, look, we've only made it this far, and it's been very dangerous. We need to just shut this thing down and wait until it is safer to travel. But in verse 11, who does the centurion listen to? Yeah, he listens to the captain or pilot, and who else? The owner of the ship. So now think about it. This is an Alexandrian ship. It's filled with grain, which means if they get to Rome and they unload their cargo, what's going to happen? They're going to get paid. So that's what they see is dollar signs. Hey, look, we've got a big load to get rid of here, and we need to go ahead and complete this trip. If we have to sit here for months, you know, October, November, December, January, February, March, we've lost almost half the year. All right? So, verse 12, because the harbor was not suitable to spend the winter in, the majority decided to put out to sea from there on the chance that somehow we could reach Phoenix, a harbor of Crete, facing both southwest and northwest, and spend the winter there. So they're going to try to make their way. You can see here the island of Crete right there in the middle of the Mediterranean. The goal is at least to try to get to the western side of it. And that ought to, by the way, show us this is how bad conditions are. Their big goal is to get from one side of Crete to the other side of Crete and see what happens. Verse 13. Now, when the south wind blew gently. So think about it. A south wind is going to at least shove them certainly more in the direction of Italy than this prevailing west wind. Supposing that they had obtained their purpose, they'd weighed anchor and sailed along Crete close to the shore. But soon, a tempestuous wind called, and I'm really curious what your Bible calls it. What does your Bible call it? The Uraquillo. That's the sort of the Latin term that's just been put into Greek and now put into English. So that's sort of like the technical name. And then some of our Bibles, rather than use the proper name for it, kind of like El Nino, you know how certain weather systems can have a special name. Some of our Bibles try to put it in the language that's more relatable to us. So what do some of your Bibles call this? A nor'easter. Yeah, a nor'easter. A northeaster. So if any of you all lived like Martha, you lived up in Maine, so you really know what a nor'easter is, right? Because when you live up in New England and those storm systems come in from the northeast, I mean, they can really pulverize you, all right? So that's why sometimes our translations will use this language, because it gives us sort of something that in our culture we can relate to. So now if they are on the trying to go under Crete, and a northeast wind comes from, do you see any possible danger here? It could just sweep them right onto the coast of Africa. And not only that, in the ancient world, there was a place that was called Syrtis, which is basically this gulf right here, which I put a triangle there because it was like the Bermuda Triangle of the ancient world. It's where a lot of ships crashed. They would run up on sand barges and they would run aground, and there would be terrible shipwrecks. So this part of the world was notorious for this. So if a northeast wind starts and it's pushing the ship that way, I mean, they are headed to potential disaster. So let's continue here. Verse 14, soon a tempestuous wind called the Northeaster or Uraquillo struck down from the land, and when the ship was caught and could not face the wind, we gave way to it and we were driven along. Running under the lee of a small island called Cauda, we managed with difficulty to do what? So they have a boat, right? Like a, we might think of it as a lifeboat, and normally in this situation, it would be connected by a rope and following along behind the main ship. But if a big storm is blowing up, what's the danger here? Yeah, it's just going to blow that ship. Kind of like the reason when we have a hurricane warning and all the stuff you've got outside your house, you got to get it in because the wind is liable to just blow it up against your house and windows and cause damage. They've got to do the same thing. They've got to secure that ship. So that's what it says at the end of verse 16 they did, although it says they did it with difficulty. Verse 17, after hoisting it up, what do they have to do with the actual ship? Not the boat, but the ship. They have to undergird it. And this is where we need the Brother Colgrove, because this would be kind of like diving in under and using ropes to help secure the main ship so it doesn't fall apart. And that's how dangerous this is. And then it says at the end of verse 17, fearing that they would run aground on the Syrtis, this Bermuda Triangle-like place, they lowered the gear, probably an anchor of some kind. They're just trying to slow the ship down. Does that make sense to you? So they're going to lower the anchor and let it drag, just to try to give them some kind of resistance so that they're not just smashed right into the coastline. Verse 18, since we were violently storm-tossed, what do they begin to do on the next day? Verse 18. They got to start dumping out the cargo. Why are they doing that? It lightens the ship because the deeper the ship sets in the water, the easier it will be to be overwhelmed by stormy waves. So what you've got to do is you've got to lighten the ship. And the way to lighten the ship is dump out the cargo. All that precious cargo that was kind of like motivating the captain and the pilot has now turned out to be not a financial asset. It's turned out to be a huge liability. And it's kind of like, you remember in Philippians when Paul says, whatever things were I counted as gain to me, at one point he says, I considered them nothing, but then he also says, I counted them as loss. And this is like a picture of what he's talking about. There were things that Paul at one time thought were assets for him, you know, his great Jewish pedigree and his zeal for the law, and he was a Pharisee of Pharisees. But he says, you know, it turns out not only were those things not an asset, it wasn't as if they were just zero. They were literally a liability. They were pulling me under, kind of like this cargo turns out to be pulling the ship under. So they've got to dump it out. Verse 19, notice on the third day how serious it is. What do they toss over? Yeah, like tackle and rigging stuff, which is, you know, the stuff they're going to be controlling the sails with. Well, if you're dumping that over, what are you basically saying? I mean, yeah, we're like Andrew said, everything but the kitchen sink, maybe even the kitchen sink. It's all going over. They're that desperate to try to lighten the ship to keep it up out of the water as much as possible. Toomer, you're digging this one, aren't you? I mean, this is like, you probably had some experiences like this down there in Key West.
The only thing, you know, you said to see anchor.
Uh-huh.
Oh,
okay. Oh, I see what you're saying. Yeah. Kind of gives you some. Yeah, very good. Did y'all hear this? We got an expert sailor over here. Very, very good. He's my technical supervisor here for this lesson. Verse 20, when neither sun nor stars appeared for many days, you know, a storm system that has come in and it's just so overcast and so thick, you can't see any light. And also, by the way, if you can't see sun or stars, what else can't you do in their day and time? Yeah, you can't navigate. I mean, you're flying blind, in other words. And no small tempest. Yeah, that's Luke's characteristic way of talking, right? So if it's no small tempest, that means, yeah, it's a large tempest. Now, sometimes our Bibles will say it like that. All hope of our being saved was at last abandoned. Since they had been without food for a long time, Paul stood up among them and said, men, you should have listened to me and not have set sail from Crete and incurred this injury and loss. Yet, now I urge you to take heart, for there will be no loss of life among you, but only of the ship. For this very night, there stood before me an angel. Now, this time, what Paul has to say is specifically said to be revealed to him by God. So an angel of God to whom I belong and whom I worship said, do not be afraid, Paul. Now, this isn't the first time we've heard things like this. Way back at Corinth in Acts 18, when, you know, remember Paul had been hauled before Gallio and the Jews were trying to get him in trouble, the Bible says that, you know, Paul was told, do not be afraid. I have many people in this city. So here we have a similar kind of message. Do not be afraid, Paul. You must stand before Caesar. And behold, God has granted you all those who sail with you. So the angel of the Lord says, you're going to get to Rome and be able to make your appeal. And everybody there with you is going to make it. So verse 25, take heart, men, for I have faith in God that it will be exactly as I have been told. So what have I been told exactly? Ship, what's going to happen to it? It's going to be destroyed. Everybody on board, saved. Me, I get to go to Rome. So Paul says that's exactly what's going to happen. But, verse 26, we must run aground on some island. And obviously, that's the only option here, right? I mean, there's not going to be a helicopter fly in and save them. And so there's not going to be any other ships out there. So the option is just to try to run aground and crash land as safely as possible. Verse 27, when the 14th night had come, as we were being driven across the Adriatic Sea, which is the sea kind of between Greece and Rome, you can see up there. About midnight, the sailors suspected that they were nearing land. So they took a sounding and found 20 fathoms. You know, they would drop something that they would, you know, count and listen for, you know, the distance. A little farther, they took a sounding again and found 15 fathoms. And fearing that we might run on the rocks, they let down 4 anchors from the stern and prayed for day to come. So stem to stern, right? So they're trying to really, you know, ease in here as much as possible. And Mike, do you think, would that have been maybe to then counterbalance the ship and lift it up a little bit? Yeah, when they dropped the anchors at the stern.
I mean, both your depth
Okay. Gotcha. All right. So that maybe that's my theory here. But we'll see what happens. Paul said to the centurion and the soldiers, unless these men stay in the ship, you cannot be saved. So Paul has been given a very explicit, specific set of details about what has to happen, right? For everything to work out. So he's telling them that. Verse 33, as day was about to dawn, Paul urged them all to take some food, saying, today is the 14th day you've continued in suspense and without food have taken nothing. Therefore, I urge you to take some food. It will give you strength. He knows they're about to crash land. You're going to have some strength to be able to deal with what's about to happen here. For not a hair is to perish from the head of any of you. And when he had said these things, he took bread and giving thanks to God in the presence of all, he broke it and began to eat. Then they were all encouraged and ate some food themselves. And in verse 37, we learn how many people are on this ship. How many people are on it? Yeah, 276. Pretty good sized ship, right? It's a big cargo ship, basically. And when they had eaten enough, they lightened the ship, throwing out the wheat. Now, you know, I don't know how much that would have weighed. They've already dumped the main cargo. But, I mean, they are literally now at the very end, even what food is left here. Verse 39, are you excited? It's like the story's been built up. This is pretty tense. Right? I mean, we know how it's going to turn out, but if you're reading it in real time, this is a pretty good story just on its own. Verse 39, now when it was day, they did not recognize the land, but they noticed a bay with a beach on which they planned, if possible, to run the ship ashore. Okay, that looks like as good a place as we can find to put this baby down is the idea here. So verse 40 says, they cast off the anchors and left them in the sea, at the same time loosening the ropes that tied the rudders. Then hoisting the foresail to the wind, they made for the beach. So they're going to try to hook into the wind and say, okay, we're going to let it drive us in there now. But, verse 41, striking a reef, they ran the vessel aground. The bow did what? So the front of the ship sticks in to this sort of like sand barge kind of thing. And so it's stuck. And what's happening to the stern or the back of the ship? You know, it's just being pounded. And so you can just imagine what's going to happen here is eventually this thing is going to fall apart. It's being broken up by the surf. Verse 42, what do the soldiers determine that they're going to do? All right, we got to kill these prisoners. We certainly can't let these people escape. We know what happens under the Roman system when you let prisoners escape. We all remember the story way back there in chapter 12 when the soldiers that were supposed to be securing Peter were executed after he got away. We know the story of the Philippian jailer who, when he thinks his prisoners were about to escape, is about to take his own life. So we know why they would be intent to do this. Verse 43, but notice, who wants to help Paul? The centurion, right, yeah. So this is a point we've made numerous times in the course of this class, that generally speaking, not always, but generally speaking, when the Roman authorities get involved with Paul, generally speaking, they either exonerate him or they at least say, hey, you can't do harm to him. Sometimes they impulsively make mistakes like they did in Philippi, but then they, when they realize he's a Roman citizen, they apologize. And we've seen this chapter 18. Gallio says, hey, this is just a Jewish dispute. These people aren't breaking Roman law. Chapter 19, when there's the riot at Ephesus and the town magistrate says, hey, look, this, we can't have a big riot like this. This needs to be handled in the you know, the proper format. The Roman governors who keep saying he hasn't done anything wrong. The centurion in Jerusalem who at first he thinks Paul's some Egyptian, you know, ringleader and assassin, but then quickly realizes, I don't know what this guy is, but he's not what they're saying he is, and protects him. I mean, over and over again, we keep seeing this. And I've said to you that while I don't think the primary purpose of this book is to serve as evidence for when Paul goes to trial, I think you can certainly argue that a secondary and very important secondary value of the book Imagine being able to go to Rome and you've got this book and you can just hand it to the authorities and say, here is a log of a lot of history. A lot of it has no relevance to this situation, but a lot of it does have relevance. And we just want you to see, we have not broken the law. Time and again, Roman authorities have said as much. And if there is trouble, it's being instigated by certain Jewish officials and not by the Apostle Paul. So this little detail here that the centurion wishes to save Paul's life is another example of the same point. Yeah, Mickey? Yeah, it is. It's either ironic or maybe even appropriate. You know, I'm not sure what the right word is, right? Oh, and by the way, something about what you just said, Mickey, made me remember this. What would be parallel, the centurion helping Paul, in a couple of stories, what would be parallel with the life of Jesus? Yeah, what does the centurion say at the cross? Truly, this was... depending on the version, this man was an innocent man or this man was the Son of God. Yeah, that kind of ties into this very same point, you see. All right, verse 43, but the centurion, wishing to save Paul, kept them from carrying out their plan. He ordered those who could swim to jump overboard first and make for the land. How many of you does that include? Who were the swimmers here? Can you swim? All right, so guard. So you all just took off. Now I'm left behind because I sink like a rock, all right? So my job is, in verse 44, I got to find a plank, some, you know, piece of, you know, debris from the ship that's falling apart to jump on. And it's going to have to be a big-sized plank. But I'm going to jump on that. So how many of you are in my boat here? You can't swim. So, all right, me and Sandy. All right, very good. So, and so it says at the end of verse 44, all were brought safely to land. Everybody made it. Some swim to shore. Some were able to grab something and just kind of float and get there. So everybody makes it. So people who are experts in the Greek language say this chapter is the most exquisite Greek in all the New Testament. We know that Luke was well-educated. He was a physician. He has technical knowledge. And this chapter, because probably the reason it has such fine Greek, I wouldn't have any clue, but it's because it's so many technical pieces of information, right, about a very narrow and specific field, which is sea travel. But it's just written very well. And even in English, I realize there's a lot of jargon you've got to work your way through, you know, the lee, rigging, etc. And then there's a lot of unfamiliar place names. But once you get a feel for what's going on here, it's actually quite a riveting chapter, just even in English, to kind of read this and see how this is all going to pan out. Yeah, Johnny, I think you had your hand up.
Well, I just kind of wondered, making so many comparisons about what Jesus did.
Yeah.
And then we just think that when they were on the boat, Jesus calmed the sea.
Yeah, now Johnny is asking a really, really fine question. If we've seen so many efforts to make Acts parallel to Luke, and even miracles, even raising people from the dead, both Peter and Paul raised someone from the dead, then why not do a miracle of stealing the storms? Now, I've never thought about that question before, Johnny, so this answer is purely extemporaneous. But here's what I would say. I'm trying to scour the book of Acts, and I don't think any apostle ever does a miracle that sometimes miracles are categorized by exorcisms, you know, casting out unclean spirits, healings, and then what are sometimes called nature miracles. Turning water to wine, calming storms, withering plants. I don't think any apostle ever does a nature miracle. Can you all think of one in the book of Acts? There's plenty of healings. And there's one guy struck blind. But I can't think of a nature miracle. And the reason for that may be, while it is true that the disciples are following Jesus and in a certain sense are parallel to him, We also have to remember that the miracles of Jesus were also designed to show that he's the Son of God, and in some sense is unparalleled. And maybe, again, just maybe the reason is, in the Old Testament, consistently there is a theme. There is one and only one person who can calm the seas and controls the seas, and that's God. And if you think about it, like I think it's in Mark 4 is his account. When Jesus does that miracle, what the disciples say is, what sort of man is this who calms the seas? So it may be just to say the disciples can do some things, but there were certain things by virtue of Jesus as creator that were going to be related to him. That's just my best guess. But it's a great question here. Now, there's a story in the Old Testament that I think is really cool to set beside this story. It's a shipwreck, sort of a shipwreck story. It could have been a shipwreck story. It turns out it's only one guy goes overboard. Story of Jonah. Now, what's parallel to the mission of Jonah and the mission of Paul? Go preach to Gentiles, right? So they both have the same mission. But then it goes complete. Paul is willing to go. Jonah, of course, wants to go the exact opposite direction. Then both of them are endangered by a storm. In the case of Paul, one man saves the lives of everybody. In the case of Jonah, one man was actually jeopardizing the lives of everybody until they have to toss him overboard, right? So I think it's just very interesting. There's probably a great sermon you could do. Somebody do that, all right? We'll put together a Bible study and look at the parallels, but also the differences between the account. All right, here is the main lesson I want us to get across here. We can't control our circumstances, but we can always try to find a way to use them for the gospel. I'm pretty confident, I can't say this for sure, but I am fairly confident that when Paul originally knew that he was to go to Rome, he didn't imagine it was going to be like this. I'm pretty confident he imagined he was going to go to Rome the same way he'd been everywhere else, freely traveling to get there. We know that he says in the book of Romans he intends to go to Rome. We know that in Acts 19 he said he was going to go to Rome, and at that point there's no indication of any perilous journey to get there, although, as we remember from our study of Acts, as the story unfolds, the big problem is going to be when he gets to Jerusalem. That's when he's told there's going to be trouble. So my guess is he didn't imagine it was going to happen through this, you know, this adventure of the shipwreck, much less that it would happen with him being a prisoner. Not at first. I think he may have obviously figured that out as it went on, but I mean at first when he's going to go to Rome. And yet, does he allow any of this to divert him from his mission? No. He's like a gospel energizer bunny. You can beat him as many synagogues as you want. He's going to go on to the next one. He'll just keep trying. And you can put him in prison as many times as you want. When he gets out, guess what? He's going to go right back to doing. And do you remember in Philippians, he says in his imprisonment, I think the one in Rome, he says, I want you to know that my circumstances have turned out for what? The greater progress of the gospel. They've turned out for the better. And he says, here's some reasons why. He says, number one, I've been able to talk to people, he says, depending on your Bible, Caesar's household, the Praetorian Guard. There are people hearing the gospel that would probably have not heard it from Paul, at least, had he not been in the imprisonment he was in. Number two, he says, the brethren here, seeing my example, have been even more encouraged to preach, so they're preaching more than had I not been in prison. So collectively, more work is being done. And then he says, there are these rotten guys who think they're going to make me jealous by saying, hey, Paul's in prison, he can't preach, so let's go out there and we'll really preach it up, and he'll get so angry and upset and jealous. And Paul says, you know what? Whether in pretense or truth, Christ is proclaimed, and in that I rejoice. So what he's saying is, you know what? As it has turned out, me being put in prison has actually made the gospel go farther than it would have otherwise. Now, that's a thing, you know, you're the great apostle Paul, to be willing to say, you know what, it's been better for me to be locked up. That takes great humility, and you have humility like that when your only focus is the gospel. What do we do to get the gospel out? And if it turns out, hey, I'm locked up here, but more people are preaching with more encouragement, and even the bad guys are preaching because they're a cuckoo, and I'm getting to talk to people I'd never gotten to talk to before, that's fine with me. The gospel's being preached. That's his mission. And so staying on point with our mission, even when circumstances are going to change, I think is one of the great examples we see from here. Well, guys, thanks for hanging in there with me. I know there's a lot of technical detail to this chapter, but I think it's one of those that if you hang in there, it pays off, right? That pays off when you study through it.